The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
In 1941, the Harvard professor and botanist Richard Evans Schultes ventured into the Amazon. He had been there many times before on research and collecting trips, but this time he disappeared into the jungle for 12 entire years. When he finally emerged, he brought with him examples of 30,000 Amazonian plant species, including 300 which were entirely new to science, 2,000 plants which had medicinal value, and hand-drawn maps of scores of rivers which no white explorer had ever seen before. He had also lived with 24 distinct Amazonian tribes and was the first outsider to study and learn 2 of the many Amazonian languages. In the end, Schultes' amazing discoveries gave us a disease-resistant form of rubber, the muscle relaxant still used in surgical procedures today, and a gold mine of other knowledge about Amazonian peoples and their use of native plants. He also, in the process, invented the entire field of ethnobotany. Amazonian plants have many medical uses, but the Amazonian languages Schultes studied contain another kind of use. Each native language is a kind of savings bank of ideas, a collection of intellectual possibilities that other cultures may never have considered. Today's guest on Thinking Aloud is Janice Knuckles, a linguist who specializes in Quechua, a vast language group which extends throughout the Andes and western Amazon. Each summer, she takes a group of BYU students with her to the jungles of Ecuador to study one dialect of Quechua. Today on Thinking Aloud, she's here to share with us more about both Quechua, the native people who speak it, and the students who go with her to learn about this fascinating culture. Thanks for listening.
It's a great pleasure to have with us Janice Knuckles, who is an anthropological linguist with field experience primarily in Amazonian Ecuador. Knuckles teaches Quechua field study classes in Ecuador during summers at the Andes and Amazon Field School in a place called the Napo Province. Her PhD is from the University of Chicago. She's been teaching at BYU since 2007. Before coming here, she held posts at Indiana University in Bloomington, the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa. It's a great pleasure to see you again, Janice Knuckles. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start out today with YouTube and make no apologies for it. I know a lot of the quality of what shows up on YouTube is not very high, but I saw an exquisitely produced piece of video just this morning. And the reason I mention it, it has to do with my family, actually. My 11-year-old daughter last night said at dinner, "Daddy, I'm going to start saving money for college now because..."
Wow.
2 reasons, she said. The first reason was, "I want to eat good food when I'm a college student."
Oh.
Apparently she's heard rumors that college kids don't eat well. And the second reason, she said, is because I want to go on a study abroad experience.
Oh.
And then following that dinner of just last night, this morning I get to see this video. It features you and your students in Ecuador. And if you go to YouTube, by the way, just go to BYU Ecuador Study Abroad. Just type that in at YouTube and you'll find it. So it's the first thing to pop up. BYU Ecuador Study Abroad. As I mentioned, this is a very highly polished piece of video and it lasts only 5 minutes, but I got a real good sense from watching that what you, Janice Knuckles, are trying to accomplish with students. And it seems to me exotic. It seems to me almost dangerous because I like to stay at home.
Good. Good. We were hoping to cultivate that perception.
But you take a small group of students down to study linguistics?
Yeah, I do indeed. I'll take as many as want to go, but it typically ends up being 8, 9, 10, 11-ish. And it can be a bit dangerous. We did notice that somebody captured a poisonous snake while we were there, a kind of a pit viper, which he very quickly disposed of. So there are dangers lurking, makes life more interesting.
Yeah.
But on the whole, it's very safe. And
the students are going to be self-selecting as fairly adventurous types anyway, I would imagine.
That's right. You have to be somebody who doesn't mind bugs too much.
Yeah. There at this field study institution, is it a small school?
It's an actual dedicated field school.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean?
Well, great question. It's a very unusual institution and setup. My colleague, Dr. Todd Swanson at Arizona State University, grew up in Ecuador. His father was a doctor, an evangelical Christian doctor who built hospitals in Ecuador to serve the people there. So he brought his family down there, and they all grew up there. My colleague has bonded with Ecuador in a big way. He married a Quechua-speaking woman. They have four kids. And so his greatest joy is to bring people down to Ecuador in the summer times, graduate students, undergraduate students who are attending universities, doing various kinds of things, and have them get to learn the language and culture of the Quechua-speaking people of Ecuador. And it's as I said, it's an unusual setup. He bought the field school. He bought a big plot of land consisting of thatched hut cabanas from a German who had built it as an ecotourism lodge. And then he turned it into his own personal field school. So,
now, these students who join with you are hoping to do what in particular with their lives? I mean, are they all going to become anthropological linguists, or what's going on there?
Well, great question. I've been asking myself the same thing. Undoubtedly, there are some who will not have much to do with anthropological linguistics when they graduate, but they want to have an experience. They want to have the experience of learning a language in a non-classroom setting where the people who speak the language are in charge and they have the power, instead of in a classroom where you might bring in a consultant from another language, but you'll have the power because you direct all the questions and they have to answer your question because they're paid consultants. At the field school, by contrast, the people who teach us are in charge, and we have to, if they don't say, you know, if they don't have certain ways of saying things, we have to deal with it.
Is this an immersion sort of a situation?
It can be. Now, English is allowed to be spoken at the field school, so we don't require everybody to speak Quechua constantly. And then there's also Spanish that they can resort to. But it's as close to an immersion situation as you can get and be practically, you know, congenial with the orientations of most students who they don't want to have to work so hard, like a very intense immersion program at Middlebury, for example. But at the same time, you know, you do need English sometimes to unpack certain kinds of meanings. So we do have indigenous people working at the field school. There are at least 25, 30 people working there at any given moment in any day. So you're surrounded by people that you can speak with if you really want to.
So the heart of the experience is really getting to know the Quechua
exactly.
people.
Yeah.
Let's chew on that term, that label, for a while, because it would be very easy and probably too simple of us to say, well, you got Russian, you got Finnish, you got, you know, Swahili, and you got Quechua. It doesn't really fit in that same, it's not in the same category as sort of these discrete languages the way we inherit that kind of sense, right?
That's a great point. In fact, there is no Quechua language academy like there is a French academy or a Spanish academy. And it's really not much of a standardized language. It's really a collection of dialects. Now, it could be argued that every language is a collection of dialects. The great linguist Uriel Weinreich once said, a language is just a dialect with an army and a navy. So Quechua speakers don't have their own army and navy, and there is certainly a lot of variability in this family of languages that we call Quechua Quechua.
Although you're in Ecuador,
right.
this term, Quechua or Quechua, extends uh-huh. for these groups of languages that right. extend all the way from Colombia to Bolivia?
Oh, even farther. So southern Colombia, all the way down the Andean backbone of South America, and up and all the way down to northern Argentina and Chile as well. So, and then, of course, eastward, it extends into the Amazonian rainforest of Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia. But the Incas themselves, who were the empire associated with Quechua, they never conquered the rainforest. So how Quechua got to the rainforest is a bit of a mystery, even today.
So if I, as a native San Diegan from California, speak with somebody from Bangor, Maine, we would consider ourselves compatriots,
right?
Possibly. There are cultural differences, but compare that if somebody's in the northern part of the of Argentina with somebody in Ecuador, would they consider themselves linguistically in the same family, or would they feel utterly foreign to each other?
I'm inclined to think that they would have a difficult time communicating, because when you get geographically very spread out, as this family of languages is, it tends to be the case that there's greater differences between the different dialects than would occur if speakers were living in close proximity.
So what is it that you study in particular? Is it a specific regional dialect? Is it are there 20,000 people that speak the language that you focus on, or 200,000?
So I speak and I study a regional dialect that has about 40,000 speakers. But to be honest with you, careful dialect studies haven't really even been done for a long, long time. And nowadays, there's so much mobility in everyone's lives that it would be difficult to say that the people who speak the dialect I'm most familiar with all live in a certain area, making it convenient for us to study them, whereas speakers of other dialects are in another area, making them, you know, geographically boundable.
And what you've just said to me hints at a story of modernization, right?
Absolutely.
Tell me what's happening in this region with the permeability of borders, with the mobility of peoples, with the introduction of new technologies. Are these indigenous peoples, are their cultures being affected? And if so, how extensively?
Well, that's a really very interesting question. And the answer is not as inevitable as we might think. To be honest with you, the people in this area who speak Quechua are culturally very heterogeneous. They may have parents who came from one language family. They may have grandparents who came from another language family. What you have in South America are many, many distinct language families that no one has been able to show as being related to each other. And Quechua is no exception. It's considered an isolated language. Yet there are speakers of other unrelated languages living cheek and jowl with Quechua-speaking people. So they're more worldly in the sense that they've traveled more than we might originally think. They have traditionally traveled a lot by river. There's a tremendous system of river networks linking people throughout Amazonia and South America. But it is true that modernization is allowing people even more mobility.
Well, as I saw the YouTube video, there's somebody holding an iPhone or there's a laptop computer, and it's being shown to some elderly citizens there, indigenous peoples, and they're pointing at the screen. And I go to the stereotypical notions of here we Western Europeans are, and we're importing all the technology and the woe and suffering that we bring with us as colonizers, right?
Right.
I'm just wondering what your reaction to that is, because these are valuable tools, but they don't seem to be overwhelmed by these technologies.
They're not. In fact, our photographer, Jaron Wilkie, said that one of the things that amazed him was that nobody really cared about his big fancy cameras. They care more about their relationships with other people. They use technology if it's to their advantage. My main consultants are ladies in their late 70s, early 80s, and they're not literate. They've never learned to read or write, and yet they manage to use cell phones. They call me about once a month to find out if I'm okay.
Here in the States?
Yeah.
Well, I bet that's a pleasant encounter every time it happens.
It is such a joy, and they always think that anything that they've heard about that has been a disaster that's happened in the United States has necessarily affected me. So they call to make sure that I'm okay, which is really touching, really sweet. Yeah.
Well, what is it that fascinates you then as a linguist that would draw you to a focus on this group of 40,000 people who speak a language that is fairly isolate? I know that you've told me that they're mobile and that there's an exchange and there's travel. Mm-hmm. But still, it's probably fair to say that it's still an isolated kind of phenomenon, this particular language, right?
Yes. And when I say isolated, I don't mean necessarily geographically isolated. I just mean linguistically, it hasn't been shown to be related to any other language in the world. But one of the things that draws me to the people is their outlook on life. I originally began studying the language because I had learned it as an undergrad, and I thought I had a foundation, so I might as well pursue it as a grad student. But then when I did my dissertation research and spent 18 months living with people in very simple circumstances, materially speaking, I developed such an admiration for them and for their way of life, and I developed social ties with them. And I'm not the kind of linguist to jump around from language to language. I tend to get very, very engaged by a particular language and realize all the things that I don't know because of what I'm constantly learning when I go and listen to the people.
You've used this phrase, their outlook on life. And immediately my mind strayed to this question. Does a unique outlook on life shared by a culture, even a small culture, does it then give shape to certain formal properties of language? Does the way a person or a group of people, the way they feel, the way they act, the way they behave, the way they perceive the world, does it then show up in their actual language, in the sounds they make, in the gestures that they use?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's a big one. And it's a contested one. So I think the language affects people's worldview. I think worldview affects people's language. And they're constantly doing a dance with each other, which is not a very elegant way to answer your question. But their outlook on life, to me, when I use that phrase, I simply mean that they haven't inherited a literate formal system of education. And so all of their learning is based on their surroundings. They read the complex environment of the rainforest the way we read library books. That's their library. That's what they learn from. And in order to learn effectively, they have to pay very close attention to the sensory properties of their environment. So they need to be able to distinguish different animal sounds, because when animals behave in certain ways, that indicates other things about plants, for example, that they might be interested in for food sources. So it's a rich and complex environment.
One of your students even made this point in the YouTube video, saying that she was amazed at the way the indigenous peoples could read the environment. And that reminds me of sort of the alienation that we often have in the highly technological realm of our world. Do your students, as well as studying language, think about a new way of relating to the natural world and to the material world, the environment around them, by observing what the Quechua are doing? Yeah.
I certainly hope so. That's my goal, is to get them to think differently about the world than they might otherwise have in a simple classroom experience-based learning situation. And I think they do. I know it's affected me, but I think it takes a while, and it takes a certain level of commitment and bonding with the people, because it wasn't until I really started to respect and like the people that I really began to learn their language.
Share with us how color is treated in this language.
And that was one of the big discoveries this summer. I'd always wondered why Quechua had so few color terms of their own, and the rest were always borrowed from Spanish. So they have a term for red, a term for black, and a term for white. And then for blue, green, yellow, they would borrow from Spanish. So one of my students decided to investigate this, and we took some manufactured objects and had our consultants look at them, and then we would point to something like, you know, a margarine tub and say, what color is this? And of course, the answer to us was obviously that it was blue. But our consultants would look puzzled. They would look at each other. They'd say, just a minute, let me go check with my aunt. And they would actually feel like they had to ask somebody. Because for them, color is not something, those kinds of colors in the blue, the green, the orange, the yellow range are all learned by the natural life forms around them. So you don't say that a certain color is blue or green. You talk about an animal feather, you know, an animal, a bird's feather, head feather, or the markings on its beak or the markings on its claws. And you say that's the color of that bird's head feather or foot or whatever. Or you default to Spanish. But what's so interesting to me about that is that, like you said, when you teach your kids basic things, you know, who doesn't read picture books to their kids? And they learn the very basic primary colors. And that's one of the first lessons we teach kids, is that all color can be reduced to this very small spectrum. What they teach by contrast is that there is no reduced spectrum, that there's lots of variability. And if you've got a blue that's different from another blue, you say that's the Pitsitsangu bird's foot, and then the other one is the toucan bird's head feather color. So in that way, they become, I think, more sensitized to the, you know, to the fine points of their surroundings.
Yeah, it's almost as though within a certain color range, they are being more attentive to the nuances of distinction, the difference between shades. Does this encounter with this particular aspect of the language help you understand what better, their language or your language? Does this reflect back on you as a speaker, a native speaker of English, in ways that either challenge you or leave you feeling maybe a little bit disoriented?
One of the things I've discovered that I question is I question boredom, because they are never bored.
This is fascinating to me. I really, genuinely.
My kids are not allowed to say, I'm bored. Okay, that is just not allowed in my house. If they say they're bored, they're put to work. Quechua people don't even think about work as work. In fact, they had to borrow a word, they had to borrow the verb for work from Spanish.
And now I'm feeling alienated yet again,
because
work and play are two very important concepts.
Yeah, they are for us, but not for them. And so, you know, one of the things that I thought when I first got there was all they ever talk about is food. They obsess about food. They tell me stories about really exciting things, like almost being grabbed by an anaconda. But they also have to tell me about the food they were eating right before that happened. And I really, you know, thought, why are they so obsessed with food? I'm so glad I don't have to bother with these mundane matters. I can go to grocery stores. And then I began to realize that that really the essence of life is to provide for yourself and to come to terms with your environment, to know it well enough so that you can learn from it and you can benefit from it and you can survive by means of it. And I began to see that for us, food is, for many people, I don't take food for granted myself anymore, but I used to just think of it as something I would buy. And for them, even people who, my consultants who are in their 80s, they live in a town now, they still manage to garden and grow a lot of their own food, because for them, that's the essence of what an interesting life consists of.
Interesting, and not just a matter of a necessary life narrative from the standpoint of subsistence.
Yeah. And in fact, even the word subsistence suggests to us that there's some base level of accomplishment there. But for them, it's, you know, I think they're almost like the original leisure class, because they don't really spend all that much time working to provide for their needs. They do spend a lot of time laughing, and, you know, they may get up in the morning and they may get to the garden at about 10 or 11. Come back whenever, you know, and nobody tells them what weeds have to be removed or which things have to be harvested. It seems like a very leisurely life, although, you know, they do work hard, no doubt about it. But at the same time, they're in charge completely of their schedule. So
I was just going to say something that does come up quite prominently in the video on YouTube. And again, that's the BYU Ecuador Study Abroad video, if you wanted to search for that. Is gesticulation, use of hand gestures or maybe even facial expressions as part of standard communication, almost part of the language?
Yes, and that's a really important new developing research interest for me, because they use a lot of imitative language, but the imitative language is often used with gestures. And I suspect that they use more gestures than other Quechua speakers, maybe because groups who speak other languages have married Quechua speakers, adopted their language, and had to acculturate to them. And I think a lot of gestures got used. This is just a hypothesis at the moment. It's working hypothesis. But I think gestures got used a lot and incorporated into their discourse practices because speakers from different languages, unrelated, unknown, were coming into their communities, and they all had to kind of adjust and adapt to each other linguistically, communicatively. And so I really do think that these expressive words that I have a special interest in may have been modeled after or borrowed from other languages that the speakers intermarried with. And then
are you saying that the gesticulations become sort of a helping, an extra layer of lingua franca?
Yes, I am. Exactly. Yeah, I'm saying that I think the gestures got used to help clarify things.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, for example, there are a lot of these imitative words that they seem repetitive in terms of the verb. So there's a verb for to be soaking wet, which you'd, of course, expect in a rainforest. But then there's an expressive word, tsung, which they say. Tsung, hukushka means to be soaked to the bone. But then tsung hukushka is like an intensified version of that. And so I really believe that it's very possible, because tsung is a really different kind of a word. It doesn't have a typical Quechua shape, that it may have been borrowed into their language. Okay. There's a word to stand straight up, shayarina. And then there's an expressive word, tsang, which sometimes when people use it, they'll stick their arms straight up in front of them to indicate that this is a really erect posture that you're imitating. Tsang shayarina. And it's just possible that this word tsang, which again doesn't resemble normal Quechua word structure, may have been borrowed from a neighboring language.
So would it be typical if I were to say that that corresponds to saying you can stand upright or you can be bolt upright. And when you say bolt, then you put your hand up and that
that's a
further
great idea.
Intensifies.
I love that, bolt upright. That's a great parallel there. Yeah, yeah.
But we in the West tend to keep our hands down.
We do. And in fact, we think when people gesture, I think they often seem excessively emotional. And there are linguists and there's a respected line of linguistic inquiry, which is increasingly coming to the point of view that gesture needs to be incorporated as part of language proper.
It needs to be.
It needs to be. Absolutely.
From sort of a psychological standpoint, that we'd be better off, what, emotionally, if we would free up our hands?
Well, I don't know. I wish linguists would care about such things, but they tend not to. But just as part of our grammar.
Of what we observe?
Part of the grammar, the grammatical description of language. It's just the case that, I mean, experimental studies by psycholinguists have found that a lot of times gestures and certain syntactic structures seem to always parallel each other and they're always used together. And one linguist, David McNeil, has suggested that there are these growth points in our psyche that from which language and gesture arise in common, which is why we gesture even when we can't see the person we're speaking with. If you're talking on the telephone with somebody, you often use gestures even though they can't see your gestures. So there's something about gestures that people seem just to need to do. And Quechua people don't repress that at all. But it is variable. So in some dialects of Quechua where you haven't seen this intense coming together of different language groups, colleagues of mine have told me that people will tell a story and their hands will be perfectly still. So the people I work with may be unusually gestural, and it may have something to do with these different communities of speakers coming in and needing to, and everybody needing to accommodate to each other linguistically.
If it weren't for the bit about the poisonous viper, you would almost have persuaded me to come with you on your next trip to Ecuador. Janice Knuckles, this has been a quick, short, but fascinating excursion for me, and I want to thank you very much for your time and for sharing a little bit of what you do in Ecuador and what your scholarship's about. Fascinating region of South America. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great fun.
Janice Knuckles with us. She's an anthropological linguist here at Brigham Young University. We hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I want to just put in a plug for that video one more time. Come to YouTube and just look it up. BYU Ecuador Study Abroad. Just search those terms. BYU Ecuador Study Abroad. You'll be well rewarded in less than 5 minutes. Visually beautiful, a little mini documentary about what goes on in a field study area there in Ecuador, and Janice Knuckles participating there. Come to our website any chance you'd like to listen to this interview or our previous interviews. You'll find us online at classical89.org/thinking aloud. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening.
Thinking Aloud is a production of BYU Broadcasting, made possible in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.